we actually place people inside of that moment of revelation to remind people that at that moment, 9/11 wasn't possible until it happened.
Just because the World Trade Center site is now a museum does not mean it's the end of the story. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The coverage of health and medical issues may actually be hazardous to your health.
We harm people when we consistently deliver inaccurate, imbalanced, incomplete coverage of new stuff. We are whipping the worried well into a frenzy.
Plus, the U.S. State Department's naming and shaming of Chinese hackers doesn't seem to be having the desired effect.
A very common statement I saw, at least on social media, was everybody's doing it. It's just that the U.S. is a bigger thief, complaining when his own stuff is stolen.
There's more coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If journalism is the first draft of history, museumification probably is the last. So OTM producer Meera Sharma and I went down to mark that moment for 9/11 on the opening day of the museum in its name, built on the footprint of the Twin Towers. You're hearing one of two huge fountains, each one roughly the size of a tower. The water flows down from long straight walls across a black square into a smaller square with no visible bottom. Surrounding the fountain is a black granite platform where the names of the dead are inscribed, arranged not alphabetically or chronologically, but in accordance with something called meaningful adjacency. Essentially, the friendships and personal relationships were mapped, and then an algorithm linked together the names. It means that someone who helped a stranger, but they both died, will be next to each other on the wall. Inside, you first encounter the sight and sound of those who saw 9/11 from afar, an estimated one-third of humanity.
I'll never forget. Oh my God, what?
I was in a coffee shop in Knoxville, Tennessee.
I'm watching my grandchild.
I was driving to work at 5:45 in the morning.
First thing I thought of was my parents. I wanted to talk to the people that I love the most.
So I started to call my friends.
Go to the end of the hall, the broad swath of blue tiles. And in the midst of those tiles is the saying in raised stone, a quote from Virgil, "No day shall erase you from the memory of time."
My dad, Michael Joseph Lindsay.
Then people reciting the names of those they personally lost.
My friend, Dan Griswold.
My father, Barry H.
Flick. Our son, John Edward Bulaga Jr.
My cousin, Alfredo Gomez
Iraita. Is someone you know?
There are walls of glossy 8x10s of the dead and a database. Is there something helpful about looking up your cousin on this database?
Well, I just told my cousin's wife that we were coming here, so I told her that I would, if I could find anything. And I just happened to walk in and the picture was right there.
Is it strange that someone you know is going to be enshrined in a museum for as long as this museum exists?
Yeah. It brings it more to home, probably. You know,
more
knowing.
To home.
Well, because I grew up in Yonkers. You know, we could see the smoke down the Metro North train station after. So that was home. And I had a lot of cousins that worked down here. And they did survive. But knowing that my cousin's cousin didn't, you know, it's hard.
I just wonder how weird it must be to have living history.
When you were living. Yeah, no, it's true. Everything we're seeing here, you know, I saw it live on TV, you know, so it's strange.
Do you think you'll come back?
I might, yeah, I might. You know, come back with other family members or whatnot, but yeah.
So it's working for you.
Yeah, they did a good job, and it came out. It's beautiful, I think.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Can I ask your name?
Patty Ann.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You don't want to
on this first day of this museum approach people who've experienced a devastating loss. On the other hand, of course I do. I'm a radio reporter. This wall of pictures was created with resources contributed by family members and friends of those killed in the attack. Wow. Wedding pictures. Jill Marr Campbell looks beautiful. Charles R. Mendez is a fireman. He looks really young. Patricia Ann Cimaroli Massari is wearing a tiara. She looks like she won a beauty pageant. Across the hall, there's a balcony, and down the stairs, the concrete stuff of toppled temples and soaring blades of twisted metal. Mira, this is the most stunning piece of bent metal that I've ever laid eyes on.
Almost like arms reaching.
Mm-hmm.
Limbs kind of twisted.
Yeah.
It's incredibly majestic, actually.
It says that it's the section of the steel facade, North Tower, floors 93 to 96.
The underbelly of the aircraft actually mangled this section of wall. There's something so oddly kind of sculptural about everything. Curves and bent metal and just the weight of it.
This looks like something John Chamberlain might have made. A lot of this stuff does. Crushed metal. Confusion of chaos and intention. You know, abstract expressionism, spontaneous and yet designed to evoke feelings in others. This whole event was designed to evoke feelings in others. Does this museum mean that the terrorists lost or won? You know, it's a stupid question anyway. I hate that question. The World Trade Center, by the numbers, approximately 50,000 people worked in it. Each tower had 110 floors. Each floor was an acre in size. On windy days, each tower would sway 12 inches side to side. There were 198 elevators in the Twin Towers and 15 miles of elevator shafts. On a clear day, you could see 45 miles in each direction from the observation deck.
Hi.
Hi. I'm looking for the room.
There's a place where they keep the toughest stuff. Not the world's witnesses, nor even the bereaved, but the perspective of those on the ground in the moment.
What we did was we made a little alcove, and we made a warning saying that this is what's in here. If you want to come in, go ahead. We also suggest not to bring kids in here, so it's not completely displayed. We give warning about it. And it is a little difficult to find, so I'll walk you over there as well.
Copy that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go through a revolving door.
Building 1 and Building 2. Marshall, evacuate all buildings in the complex. You copy? All buildings in the complex.
Fire department. They're coming through the building, sir. I got almost every fireman in the city coming to help you. I understand. Just sit tight. The best we got, we'll get to you as soon as we can.
Sensory assault. You have the text, the images, the audio playing. It's like being inside this kind of horror vortex or something.
My first thought was that I'm dead. And then I started to smell smoke. I felt above my head. There was a slab of concrete that had fallen at an angle. And at that point, I heard someone behind me say, "Don't leave me." He grabbed my ankle, he moved behind me, and I just started digging.
The next thing I remember was just a bright, bright light. And somebody said, "If you see the light, come to the light." I'm hearing noises, and I'm hearing, "Help me," and it just sounds surreal, like I'm in a dream or something.
I just now started picking people up and saying, "Wait here, I'm going to step out and look up, and when I tell you to go, you need to go like you've never gone before."
So 20 minutes later, I saw a little peephole of light. I was able to make a small hole. So I said to the man behind me, I'll squeeze you through the hole. I pushed him up. I squeezed myself through the rebar. I scraped my body down completely. We were on a pile of rubble. It was red hot. My shoes began to melt into the girder as I was standing there. All around me was like being in a blizzard. It was just paper, gray smoke, everything swirling.
As we're going along, you're like kind of picking up people that are wandering. People are disoriented because nothing looks the way it did an hour ago. The whole area was gray. Even when you looked up, all you saw was gray.
Cece Lyles is a flight attendant. She leaves a message for her husband.
Baby, you have to listen to me carefully. I'm on a plane that's been hijacked. I'm on the plane. I'm calling from the plane. I want to tell you I love you. Please tell my children that I love them very much. And I'm so sorry, they, I don't know what to say. There's three guys that hijacked the plane. I'm trying to be calm. We're turned around. And I've heard that there's planes that have been flown into the World Trade Center. I hope to be able to see your face again, baby. I love you. Bye.
There's an alcove with photos of those who chose to jump rather than burn, both at the moment of decision and then plummeting, floating. There's also quotes from those who watched, like James Gilroy. She had a business suit on. Her hair was all askew. This woman stood there for what seemed like minutes, and then she held down her skirt and stepped off the ledge. I thought, how human, how modest to hold down her skirt before she jumped. I couldn't look anymore.
Sure, we have 7 patients, and more patients are coming to us. Parkways and West Broadway.
Though the visitors certainly were solemn, there were no tears. Maybe after more than a decade of anniversaries, the national mantle of mourning no longer suits the time. After all, the city and the nation have seen many catastrophes. This was a huge one, but perhaps more important, it was our catastrophe. 50 years from now, it will be a catastrophe. And it's in places like these that future generations will experience it. What that experience will be like for them, we can't possibly know.
I'm Jake Barton, principal and founder of Local Projects. We're the media designer and production firm for the 9/11 Memorial Museum.
What was the hardest thing?
The hardest thing about the project was trying to balance between the emotional safety of the visitors, a young adult, a 15-year-old who knows literally nothing about this day, and on the other side, first responders or people who ran out of the burning buildings for their lives. And so trying to make an authentic and frankly meaningful experience for both audiences was an incredible challenge.
When you walk in, you hear this montage of voices, people who experienced it from a distance. But when you go through the revolving doors, you are then put in the path of the direct experience of the people on the site at that moment.
We gathered voices from all around the world through the internet, through phone, through a story booth that we had here on site. And it brings us back onto our own memories. When you go into the historic exhibition, you are literally placed into that moment. And it, frankly, is a moment of confusion and of revelation. You hear some people repeating misinformation, claiming on the news that this is just a small Cessna plane, it's clearly an accident. We actually place people inside of that moment of revelation to remind people that at that moment, 9/11 wasn't possible until it happened.
The museum's role is to create an experience for a generation that has no contact with it, like the Lincoln Memorial. Mm-hmm. How do you go about imagining how that might be experienced in 50 years?
I think both the memorial and certainly the museum have a very interesting relationship with time. 9/11, it's not history, right? Because it's still unfolding and its effects are literally being played out in headlines today, whether it's about Guantanamo, the Middle East, personal security and freedom, to all of these ways in which the post 9/11 world is continuing to evolve and change. And yet, it's definitely not current events. It's somewhere in between. And so The museum's job, I think, is both to preserve the memories, to tell the full story, but frankly, to do what it can to play a productive role within all of the conversations that are literally defining this post-9/11 world.
The Hall of History doesn't tell us about what was going on in Afghanistan in the 80s and doesn't talk about America's role in frequently over the decades supporting unpopular leaders in the region and generating hostility thereby.
So it's a big museum. There's a lot in it. There's actually really strong overt references to the history of the Middle East, to the rise of the radical fringe that led to Al-Qaeda, including America's role within the Middle East and certainly within the...
I'm just appalled that I seem to have strode right by that section. There are certain things that you really can't avoid passing through.
No question.
You know, this sort of historical part, I guess it was a decision not to make it an obligatory walkthrough.
Yes, definitely, definitely. We opted for a museum experience where there are different levels of disclosure. And so we don't necessarily have a children's exhibit, but we do have a general interstitial space, which is actually the majority of the museum, that is really absent of the toughest parts of the story. It has a crushed fire truck, and it has pictures of the towers there and gone. It has missing posters. It has the last column. But you have to actually enter through those revolving doors into the historic exhibition to get the story of the day and the day before and the aftermath. And then even within there, there are different alcoves that tell even tougher parts of the stories. From inside the towers, from inside of Flight 93, it's essentially allowing people to, again, make the choice to go in and to be confronted with the most difficult material inside the museum.
So much of this, I mean, I am a big art museum goer.
Sure.
And I would see a Chamberlain sculpture and a Richard Serra structure and things that look like religious iconography.
Yep.
Did any of that strike you?
There was a ton of conversation during the planning and design process about how to distinctly actually avoid aestheticizing different parts of this experience, because the artifacts themselves are so powerful, it's just not appropriate to try and put something on top of them.
Our natural tendency to anthropomorphize makes you see arms reaching up to heaven or twisted limbs. There's a lot of pain that's evoked by those inanimate objects, even if we saw them entirely absent of 9/11 as a context.
No question. I think the context, though, because you're inside of essentially the largest artifact, the void that the museum fills, the original infrastructure that held the towers, and you're on the site, this hallowed ground, it charges the atmosphere and the mind so that when you see the fire truck that we have inside the historic exhibition, one part of it that you encounter is completely pristine. It's almost untouched. And then when you turn a corner, you see the front, which is completely charred, completely destroyed. We couldn't help but notice that's essentially a metaphor for the day. You turned left, you lived. You turned right, you perished. And that was simply the fact of that day, just based on how the towers went down and on the lives that were lost.
Jake Barron of Local Projects, the media designer and production firm for the 9/11 Memorial Museum. A word about that controversial gift shop. It had lots of books, ranging from collections of photos to personal recollections to the 9/11 report to histories like the Looming Tower. There was an NYPD jacket for your dog. In fact, there were a lot of tributes to search and rescue dogs. There were I Love New York More Than Ever mugs, images of that survivor tree found living in the rubble on mugs and T-shirts. There was a sweatshirt with the saying, "In darkness we shine the brightest." Seems a delicate notion for a hoodie, but we were offended by none of it. The reality is, 9/11 was commodified long ago. Now it lives in a museum, and people may want a little something to remember it by. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Hover. helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code TLDR. On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. If you've been thinking about starting your own business, LegalZoom can help you do it. Learn more about DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, trademarks, and other ways to protect your business and assets at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In an unprecedented move this week, the U.S. Justice Department brought charges against five Chinese military officers for allegedly hacking American companies in an act of economic espionage. Here's FBI Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Carlin during the Justice Department press conference on Monday.
For the first time, we are exposing the faces and names behind the keyboards in Shanghai used to steal from American businesses.
Yes, names and faces, because the FBI also released wanted posters with the images of the alleged hackers, two of whom are shown in their Chinese military uniforms. This is all part, apparently, of the name and shame strategy, putting a face to cybercrime, since, really, without an extradition agreement with China, the U.S. government has no recourse here. If anything, the indictments appear to be more of a media campaign against the Chinese.
China's military has attacked major U.S. companies in a computer war that kills American jobs.
It all comes down to hackers trying to find a shortcut for Chinese businesses to get ahead of American businesses.
If they're stealing our stuff, put them in prison and throw the key away.
Unsurprisingly, the Chinese media have a different perspective on this hacking indictment. Jeremy Goldkorn monitors Chinese media and joins me now from Beijing. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be here, Bob.
The Chinese media are playing this move by the Justice Department as hypocritical and outrageous in the light of, let's say, NSA spying and the PRISM program that was revealed by Edward Snowden.
Yeah, that is the universal line. I mean, every editorial and just about every piece of criticism on social media that I've read somehow refers to Edward Snowden and the NSA. The Global Times, a rather nationalistic state-owned newspaper, had some particularly colorful language in their English edition. They called the U.S. a mincing rascal and various other words for hypocrisy. The Chinese edition called the U.S. a preening high-grade hooligan.
Now, does nobody at least acknowledge the difference between spy agencies spying on individuals on supposed national security grounds and economic espionage, which is at the heart of this case? I mean, there's a difference between being a snoop and being a thief.
Certainly that distinction is made in the United States. I haven't seen that distinction acknowledged by any of the media reporting in China.
Now, putting the shoe on the other foot, it seems to me that if China made all sorts of accusations about Americans in the military or the government committing some sort of economic crime, the American press would do its due diligence to see if there's anything to the accusations. Has any of the Chinese press taken up the question of whether there's merit to these charges?
No, they haven't, and they won't, because the media control authorities will not allow it. This is a case where the government doesn't have to work too hard on getting everybody to stick to the party line, because the sense of outrage at the U.S. is very widespread. But nonetheless, because it involves a case of some kind of sensitivity that involves the image of China abroad, the propaganda controls will be quite strict.
Is there any way to know if some percentage of the Chinese population is actually, instead of pointing its finger at the hypocritical U.S., just going, yeah, that kind of scans? That sounds like our People's Liberation Army.
Yeah, I think there probably are many people who think that China is doing it. I don't think that the outrage here is because they think it's a lie. I think the outrage is because they think the U.S. is just as bad and explicitly criticizing individuals is the thing that is causing the outrage. I mean, a very common statement I saw, at least on social media, was everybody's doing it. It's just that the U.S. is a bigger thief complaining when his own stuff is stolen.
The mugshots were an interesting twist here, presumably to put a face on the otherwise fairly abstract business of cybercrime. And it's hard to know exactly what the U.S. intended, but at least one commentator, Evan Osnos of The New Yorker, suggested that it could backfire by turning the accused into folk heroes, anti-heroes, just plain heroes. Is there any evidence that these guys are benefiting from the attention?
Well, there certainly has been quite a bit of chatter in the media and on social media along the lines of these people are heroes, and maybe drawing such attention to their individual identities is the reason that people are thinking that. This is seen as a provocation by America and as a very purposeful shaming of Chinese people who work for the People's Liberation Army.
And finally, that, my understanding that shame is a particularly resonant emotion in Chinese culture. I imagine someone in the State Department saying to the people at the Justice Department, well, you know, saving face is very, very important to the Chinese. Perhaps if you could shame them, it would have an effect even more than any kind of criminal indictment. If that is what is happening, do you think it's had any effect whatsoever?
I don't think the shame is being felt on this side of the Pacific. I don't know what's going on inside the secret buildings controlled by the People's Liberation Army. My gut instinct is that this isn't going to have much of an effect. But you never know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I do know this, that I've just asked you to speculate on my speculation, which is what I make a living ridiculing about cable news. Oh, I am such a mincing rascal. Jeremy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Goldkorn is founder and editor of the website Danwei, which monitors media in China. He spoke to us from Beijing. Amid the media maelstrom over last week's firing of executive editor Jill Abramson, the New York Times also had to deal with an embarrassing leak. BuzzFeed was fed a 96-page internal Times report on the paper's adaptation or non-adaptation to the digital world. Joshua Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, wrote about the innovation report. Prepared over the course of 6 months, the report paints a sorry picture of recalcitrance in the face of change.
The New York Times was very good at putting out a print newspaper. It's something they got very good at over a very long period of time. And when the medium shifts, you know, no matter how good you are in one medium, you're sort of playing catch-up in another. And that was one of the things that I thought was interesting in the report, that Twitter, social media, basic promotional tools, very inconsistent about how those were used from reporter to reporter or section of the paper to section of the paper. So there are a lot of ways that the Times could be tagging its content, using it to analyze what's working and what isn't working. A lot of those things they're just not doing.
The Times, of course, has a digital offering and a mobile one, and they both have lots and lots of reach. And they've done some very high-profile digital projects. But if the report tells you anything, it's that the mentality of the paper is still utterly print-centric.
I think that is true. You know, Arthur Sulzberger has said that he views the Times as platform agnostic, that they produce journalism, that journalism goes into a print product, a digital product, an app, a website, other platforms, and it doesn't really matter. That's a nice thing to say. It's a different thing for that culture to really change and for that message to penetrate through the editors, through the reporters.
When we talk about culture, the report would suggest that it begins with page one, how for more than a century, the focus is to create great stories that might find their way to page one, and everything flows from that. Why does that make so little sense in a digital world?
Well, think about how the day works. You have meetings in the morning and in the afternoon. You have editors who are crafting good pitches, trying to get their reporters' stories onto page one, an admirable thing, which means that those decisions are made later in the day. Well, the morning is the peak traffic time for the New York Times. They're pushing out all their big stuff in the evening because that's how the process works. Compare that to a newsroom that thinks of digital as their main point of output. They're going to be putting out content on a more regular basis. They're not going to be constrained by this one flow, which made perfect sense for a print product that was produced once a day. What was surprising to me about this report was that the New York Times is much more advanced than most American newspapers in creating a digital strategy. They have built one of the few really clearly successful paywalls. They have created enormously wonderful projects. They seem to be figuring it out. And that's why it was kind of sad, frankly, for me to read the report and to really see that the cultural changes, you know, hadn't really taken hold. And there are absolutely brilliant digital people at the New York Times. They have more technical capacity than any other news organization in the country. They simply don't always value it to the degree that they probably should.
Is the newsroom so hidebound that it regards the digital staff not only with suspicion but as kind of the enemy?
I wouldn't put it that strongly, and it's difficult to talk about the newsroom as a single entity. I mean, it's 1,300 or so people who have very different opinions about things. But I don't think there's any doubt that there is a culture clash between individuals, between ways of thinking about the news. There's a broad commitment to Timesianness, I think, among just about everyone who works there. But there are a lot of different ways you can get to that endpoint, and I don't think everyone agrees about those ways.
There have been a couple of impediments at the Times, according to the report, that probably sound familiar to journalists and newsrooms all over the world. And one is the notion of church and state. Journalists have always taken pride in having nothing to do with the business side.
Yeah, it was very easy to not have any knowledge of what was going on the business side when the business side was doing great. There's a lot of intelligence within the Times building about how audiences engage with Times stories. It would seem to me that it would make sense for journalists, people who produce those stories, to have knowledge of how their audiences is reading those stories or watching those videos. That sort of intelligence can come in through the business side, or it can come in through an in-newsroom analytics team, as the report proposes. But it's important information. And one of the tensions ever since the web arrived in newsrooms was, how much do journalists want to let their judgments be affected by data? And that's still an open question in a lot of newsrooms.
Another issue of culture is the sense of not wanting to pander to the whims of the mass audience, which is what adapting to data is kind of about. If there's a continuum of digital media, and on one side of it is the New York Times, and on the far other pole is, let's say, BuzzFeed, I guess the future of digital is that they are going to, whether they like it or not, move toward one another. BuzzFeed's moving. They have a Washington Bureau, and the Times seems very reluctant, perhaps not at the executive levels, but within the newsroom, to move in the direction of optimizing the distribution of its stories. Is that ever going to change?
Well, I would disagree with the idea that there's a spectrum, and on one end is really high-quality journalism, and at the other end is understanding what your audience wants. I think those can easily live together. The Times has built up this tremendous brand. Their mission is going to continue to be as high quality a journalism outfit as they possibly can. But that mission does not conflict with understanding what your audience wants. I mean, it's not as if newspapers all started sports sections decades ago because they all had that same idea just on a whim. It's because they realized that their audience wanted sports coverage. There's always been an effort to align the product you're producing with the demands of the market. That's not a sin. That's not a crime against journalism. One of the things that the report said is that a number of digital side people complained that journalists, when they were talking about learning about audience data or understanding what the numbers showed, had a tendency to always go to the worst case scenario. Like, well, if we look at these numbers, next thing you know, it's going to be the Britney Spears New York Times, and that's all we're going to cover. I think you can benefit from the knowledge that digital data gives you about your audience without selling out your soul.
Josh, thank you very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Joshua Benton is director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University.
Coming up, are the problems that plague health reporting incurable?
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Gary Schweitzer has devoted his life to reviewing how health news is reported, and more often than not, misreported. We last spoke to him in 2009 when, in the face of continuously ham-handed health reports, he decided to stop examining network television coverage of health altogether. Here's Gary at the end of our last interview.
I believe that we have given over the airwaves to these companies that are abusing that privilege and misinforming the public inaccurately, in an imbalanced way, and incompletely. Yeah, that's, I think, how you define a disgrace.
But now, Gary's back. His website, healthnewsreview.org, gathered a team of experienced reviewers to evaluate 1,899 health stories covering innovations in health science. His study, reviewing stories from 2006 to 2013, appeared earlier this month in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Schweitzer and his team judged the success or failure of these stories about new stuff in healthcare by developing and asking a set of very focused questions.
In reporting about how wonderful something was, did it actually discuss the cost? Did it adequately explain the size of the potential benefit and the size of the potential harm? Did it evaluate the quality of the evidence? Did it have more than a single source, and did it look at conflicts of interest in the source? Did the story rely solely or largely on a news release? Was it reporting on something that was truly available, or was this a phase one study that is years away? In reporting on the new, which is what our job is in journalism, did it also put the new into the context of existing alternatives, which by default have a longer, more proven track record?
Let's talk about some of the more common errors. On the subject of statistical literacy, one of them that you divined was the confusion of risk reduction in relative terms versus absolute terms. Tell me what that looks like when it goes wrong.
It's like having a 50% off coupon at Macy's, but you don't know what that 50% off coupon can be applied to. It can be applied to a diamond necklace or to a pack of chewing gum. Until you answer that, you don't know the absolute value. You only know the relative value. So let's not talk about a drug reducing the risk of something by 50%. 50% of what? If we're talking about a change from 2 in 100 having a problem down to 1 in 100, that indeed is a 50% relative risk reduction, but to people with this condition, it's a difference of 1 in 100. And it means that everybody else who didn't benefit had to take the drug, pay for it, run the risk of side effects, and didn't get any result.
Another big problem is the failure to explain the limits of observational studies. What do you mean by that?
I'm now into my second cup of coffee, and coffee stories lead the league in observational studies, it seems. So if I take half of your station and have them drink coffee for 5 years and keep a diary of what happens to them and another half doesn't, I cannot say at the end of that observation that coffee raised or lowered their risk of stroke, because you cannot make a causal link from an observational study. It's not a true experiment. And over and over and over again, we use active causal verbs like raised risk, lowered risk, boosted protection to describe observational studies, and it's simply inaccurate.
Because correlation is not causation.
Yeah.
The reporters, me among them, love to put a human face to an otherwise abstract story. You know, give it a little flesh and blood. But the anecdote bedevils you as a reviewer of health news. Why?
Because that is possibly the leading category of imbalance. We tell the positive patient stories, but we don't tell about the dropouts from the trials, the people who couldn't maintain the regimen. Why couldn't they stay with it? I think you got to feel the hand of the medical marketing mavens when you see just these positive, glowing success stories, which dominate American health news.
One of the almost universal problems was new technologies being reported kind of uncritically as the next big thing. Why do you think journalists get all wide-eyed when the subject is medicine and health?
When you're talking about proton beam radiation therapy machines that require a linear accelerator the size of a football field, it is gee whiz. It's all the kind of stuff that gets you on page one. It also should be the kind of stuff that we're reporting, whoa, let's put the brakes on and look at where we have the evidence and where we don't for how this is any better than what we're already using.
Is it the triumph of hope over journalistic skepticism that drives this, or something more sinister?
Look, Bob, nobody who covers this stuff rolls out of bed in the morning and says, how can I go in and hurt people today? But as we've shown, we harm people when we consistently deliver inaccurate, imbalanced, incomplete coverage of new stuff. We are whipping the worried well into a frenzy. I'm going to talk squarely out of both sides of my mouth right now, Bob. I want to acknowledge that we simultaneously are seeing some of the best healthcare journalism we've ever seen, with special in-depth investigative data-driven projects often by foundation-supported efforts like ProPublica and Kaiser Health News. We are seeing some of the best. But this daily drumbeat of dreck that occurs in between these special projects, we would be better off with far less news coverage.
With the same mistakes made over and over and over, do you not tire of your efforts? Are you the Don Quixote of healthcare reporting?
If I didn't think that this could affect meaningful change, I wouldn't keep doing it. But I should tell you that, in fact, an end has been enforced on me, at least temporarily, but maybe permanently, because the 8 years of foundation funding that I had to do this has ended. I've kept my site alive by my own individual blogging. I've not been able to find another source to fund this kind of work. I think one of the reasons for that is that almost every day, with almost everything we write, we upset somebody in journalism, but we also upset somebody in healthcare who liked the way that shoddy journalism was making their idea look better than it really may have been. So you tell me, who is going to fund this kind of stuff?
Good luck, and thank you.
Well, thank you again for your continued interest in our work.
Gary Schweitzer is publisher of the website healthnewsreview.org.
Health and science reporter Virginia Hughes takes the problems confronting health coverage personally. Take earlier this month when she came across a new study about resveratrol, you know, that chemical in red wine that over the years has been both heralded as heart-healing and dismissed as bogus. So she went back and reviewed earlier headlines about resveratrol in the New York Times. The first, August 2003, life-extending chemical is found in certain red wines. But in the years since, the headlines have ranged from charges of fraud to new optimism to inconclusive studies to more skepticism and then more optimism. This head-spinning trajectory is the norm in such stories because science is a process. So what's even the most conscientious health reporter to do? Hughes posted about the saga of resveratrol on her blog Only Human, hosted by National Geographic magazine. And she sparked a big debate among health journalists themselves about the perils of reporting the latest health news.
Science is iterative and often incremental, and the news is the news. And so science journalism is molded into a heffalump of both, where every new study suddenly becomes a news peg. Every week we get the embargo email from Nature with all the studies that are going to be out the following week. And same for science, and same for the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. We're on this timeline, and it's kind of a forced arbitrary one because each paper has been in the works for months, if not years. So it's actually totally arbitrary calling it news.
Now, unlike a lot of other beats, when you read an article about health, it's often personally relevant. So tell me, what are people looking for from health journalists?
Yeah, it's really interesting for me because I often cover science as well as health. I think people come to, say, a neuroscience story with a lot more open curiosity, I guess. They come to a health story looking for practical advice about how they can be healthier or live longer. They really want the bottom line. And I do too, as a consumer.
But to be absolutely true to the nature of science, you can't, in your reporting, imply a better way to behave, right?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. We shouldn't be. But on the other hand, it's implicit. If you're covering something, the reason is because you think your reader is going to glean something from it.
Have you developed any behavior or attitude towards resveratrol, the drinking of red wine?
I drink a lot of red wine. It has nothing to do with resveratrol, though.
And it never crosses your mind?
No, it doesn't. But where I do get caught up is the dietary stuff of carbs or fat or no fat. And they constantly get overturned and debunked. And I really have gotten really cynical about dietary science of just, screw this. I'm not listening to anything that you guys say. I'm just going to eat in moderation and do what I want.
Sometimes the stakes are fairly small, but sometimes, as you've noted, they can be very high, like this confusion over cancer screening.
Oh, absolutely. And especially something like cancer screening, the experts don't agree. So journalists are covering an active debate among scientists, and the good journalists will be honest and transparent about that debate and about the pros and cons. The bad ones, or the time-strapped ones, will present advice, you know, cloaked in a scientific brand, and then leave it at that.
Do you have a particularly sticky wicket of a study that you wrestled with for a while?
I have a story about a post that I have come to regret a little bit. A couple of months ago, I covered a story about weed. It was a rodent study showing that the rodents who were exposed to very high levels of THC, their children ended up having some kind of cognitive issue, I think. I mean, it was kind of basic biology, and there was nothing wrong with the study. And I fully reported it. I sought out second opinions. It's totally legitimate funding. But my headline was weed, colon, a gateway drug across generations, question mark. And the picture I used was a dude with, like, smoke surrounding him. And the comments were insane. I mean, hundreds of comments, and they were all really angry with me because the context that I had kind of missed, I think partly because of my age and partly because I was just ignorant of it, is that the negative effects of weed have kind of been debunked over the last 30 years. I think I probably shouldn't have covered it, or I could have been much more careful about it.
You asked your readers within the health science journalism community to talk about what could be done to better cover health. And you came up with a bunch of solutions, right?
Yeah. One of them is explanatory journalism. The idea is that we don't necessarily need to follow the straight news pyramid where the new stuff's at the top and then there's a paragraph of background and then the implications are at the bottom. Like, you could actually have links and allow the reader to explore at their own interest level. Another was to report on a batch of studies at once. So instead of reporting on the latest resveratrol study, maybe take a look back and look at the previous 10 studies or...
Do that with every new study?
That's hard. That takes a lot of work. And especially for blogs, you're not paid as much as you are for straight news reporting. Another was, what if you told the story of how the science is done? You focused more on the methods and the design rather than the results and the bottom lines. Those stories can be really fun. I think they're just not as well received. People don't necessarily want to read that as much as they want to read what should I do about drinking wine.
It sounds like what you're saying. In order to do the best possible job reporting on health science, you have to deny the reader what they most want.
I don't like the idea of denying readers. I'm supposed to be a slave to my readers, right? Maybe it's about lowering their expectations.
How do you do that?
by inserting debate and nuance and doubt. I hate stories that treat science as some holy sphere that has the answers to everything, because it's absolutely not. And being wrong is sort of built into the process of science.
You wrote in your blog post, "The science of health is so, so confusing. I almost wonder if it wouldn't be better for journalists to stop writing about health altogether."
Almost. 90-some percent of all biomedical research in this country is funded by the public, and the public deserves to know what they're paying for. I just think we need to be a little bit more selective about what we cover and more honest and transparent with readers about what those studies are showing. I think now I'm coming around, the only reason I would ever cover a study that I thought was subpar is if it's getting a crazy amount of attention on mainstream outlets, and I felt like I needed to counter that.
Well, Virginia, thank you for fighting the good fight.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
Virginia Hughes is a science journalist in New York. Her blog, titled Only Human, is hosted by National Geographic magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Meera Sharma. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Leslie Sisson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.